In recent weeks, Donald Trump has warned the upcoming election will be rigged if voter ID laws continue to be struck down. Here he is on Fox News.
I'm telling you, November 8th, we better be careful because that election is going to be rigged. And I hope the Republicans are watching closely or it's going to be taken away from us.
Joining us now to talk about this is Michael Kang. He's a professor at the Emory University School of Law. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks very much for having me.
What do we have a sense of what Donald Trump means by rigged when he says it?
It's hard to tell what Donald Trump is talking about a lot of the time. I think in this case, he's saying that it's going to be there's going to be illegality and there's going to be election fraud on the side of the Democrats to help decide the election in Hillary Clinton's favor over him. It's hard to tell how serious he is about that claim.
Well, let's hear President Obama's reaction to Trump's claims. This is the president during a recent press conference.
Of course the elections will not be rigged. What does that mean? The federal government doesn't run the election process. States and cities and communities all across the country, they're the ones who set up the voting systems and the voting booths. And if Mr. Trump is suggesting that there is a conspiracy theory that is being propagated across the country, including in places like Texas, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. And I don't think anybody would take that seriously.
And yet, Michael, I hate to try to compare the silver screen to real life, but we're all kind of used to seeing shows like House of Cards or Scandal, in which voting one or the other of the party goes around stuffing ballot boxes or removing ballot boxes completely. Is there a way for an election to be rigged by one of the parties?
It's very hard for election fraud to swing an election from the outcome that otherwise would have happened. And I think our system has lots of problems. It doesn't seem that election fraud is one of the major ones, certainly nothing on the scale that Donald Trump suggests. It's exceedingly rare for election fraud to swing an election.
Especially a presidential election as opposed to like a local small election.
Right. The cases that we've seen election fraud that really are on large enough scale to swing an election have occurred at the local level, usually mayoral races.
Now, here's the kind of sticking point, Michael, because according to the Pew Research Center, less than half of Americans are confident that votes in this country are accurately counted. That's after the 2004 election. After 2012, that percentage actually fell to 31%. Only 31% after 2012, which was the last presidential election that we have, believed votes were accurately counted. Why does the American public have so little faith in its own elections?
Well, there's a couple different things. I think one is they're probably right to have a limited amount of confidence that the votes are accurately counted in a certain sense. That is, there's lots of mistakes in the election system, and that's a problem. It doesn't necessarily have to do very much with fraud. It has to do with the fact that we don't invest a great deal in our election system. And so a certain lack of confidence in the counting of votes kind of makes sense. It's not always connected with a belief that election fraud is changing elections. The fact that the votes aren't counted perfectly accurately in every instance may be warranted, but it doesn't necessarily mean that election outcomes are going to be changed. You need to change a lot of votes to change an election outcome, and it's hard to do through fraud.
Okay, so let me play you a few comments from people that our producers spoke to on the streets of Atlanta. They asked them if they thought elections here were rigged. Here's Stacey Torrey, 48 years old, lives in Midtown.
There's a certain percentage of my soul that thinks that it is, only because what isn't rigged in this country? I think Big Brother is watching. I think everything is connected to someone having their ability to call what the final outcome is, and our vote, unfortunately, in the long run, doesn't really matter.
Okay, so that's one. Let me play you one more before I get your response. This is Bob Harmon. He's a 72-year-old physician.
No, I don't. I think the parties have their rules. The states have their rules. We have federal election rules. I think it's about as good as it can be. I wish the turnout were higher. And I wish we had more electronic voting, although there are security issues around it.
And let's talk about that electronic voting that Bob mentioned there. Is electronic voting, because people are talking about bringing back a paper ballot, is electronic voting more secure or less secure than a paper?
Depends on who you ask. I think as an election law scholar, on the law side, tend to be a little bit more optimistic about electronic voting. But my friends from computer science are the ones that usually raise the warnings about the vulnerabilities in the system. We don't have a lot of reason to feel that there's been fraud through kind of hacking or other means taking advantage of any vulnerabilities in electronic voting. But a lot of experts on that side have pointed to potential problems that might arise in the future.
Okay, so for those of you out there listening, let's pose to you the same question we asked people here in Atlanta. Do you think rigged elections could happen in the U.S., especially on a national level? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation on Facebook. My guest is Emory Law Professor Michael Kang. So, Michael, we got this kind of scary announcement from the FBI saying they'd uncovered evidence that foreign hackers had actually penetrated two state election databases. And from the point of view of the law, let's say a hacker from outside the country did penetrate a state election database. What does that mean about the election outcome there?
Well, that would be new territory. It's hard to tell what a court could do really with that. I mean, I would imagine it would depend on how confident we are about the judgment that the election outcome had been affected in a negative way. And then the court would have to apply some remedy, either, I guess, if the problems were on large enough scale, maybe even redo the election or try to remedy it as best as you can without doing that.
Have we ever had to redo a national election?
No. I think for instance, a presidential election to be swung by something like election fraud would require a pretty large-scale effort and something that would be really difficult to pull off in today's age.
So here's another question which we've never encountered before. Because of some of the comments that Donald Trump has made, people have begun to ask what happens if one of the candidates loses and does not concede. And I wonder, that has never happened before. We've never had a presidential candidate for certain not conceded eventually. So is there systems in place should one of the candidates not concede?
Well, I guess it would depend on how that sort of plays out. I think it's a worrisome possibility, and Donald Trump's comments about elections being rigged, kind of his prediction and certainty about it in the future, raises exactly that specter. I'm not sure what we could do about that. I guess it would depend on why he's saying that and how believable his grounds are for denying the outcome of election. But I guess
we should
really
mention that at this point he has not released any evidence so far of a rigged election or tampering with any election systems or anything like that.
Exactly.
We just have the his belief that the election may be rigged. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, yeah, that's right. It's an entirely a prediction made with a certain amount of certainty. But I think there's really no whatever the legal response is, if that's sort of the question, I think it would really depend on what he's doing and what problems that raises.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different problems that could be raised. And I guess it comes down to whether or not it would end up yet again in the Supreme Court. Is there a chance that the courts could again weigh in on a presidential election?
Yeah. I mean, I think we've got an election system that increasingly is turning to the courts to make calls on all different kinds of things since Bush versus Gore. I think there was once a time when it was thought that turning to the courts was really not a respectable move. And we have lots of instances where losing candidates have decided that they didn't want to fight it out in the courts because they thought they'd be branded as a sore loser, for instance, Richard Nixon in 1960. But I think in today's world where there's fundraising specifically for recount fights, that's totally a predictable eventuality that we'll again see elections litigated all the way to the Supreme Court, at least in certain instances. And if there's credible allegations that there are problems in the vote counting in the fall, then certainly we could see that happen again, although I'm sure the Supreme Court would love to avoid that if at all possible.
Certainly, because it's still a topic of conversation since the last time that happened. Let's hear one more comment from someone our producer spoke to. This is John Gunter, a 50-year-old patient services coordinator with Kaiser Permanente.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily rigged, but I do think that the media definitely plays a role in how they portray the candidates and how they can twist stories and persuade people to vote.
Okay, so that's John calling out me and the rest of my colleagues in journalism. And I wonder, to what extent is that also rigging? Do we include media coverage as Americans or legally in our ideas of whether something is a free and fair election?
I think these comments are really interesting, and I think you're right to think that at least some of the sentiment is grounded in dissatisfaction with all different aspects of our system, including the media. I think a few of the comments that you aired before, there's a kind of unhappiness with the structural kind of inequality in American society, at least in their view, and the way that there are certain entrenched interests that seem to have a kind of advantageous position. And it's really a worry about the way our society works, and that spills over into a concern about how the election system works. I don't know if a lot of the sentiment is really grounded in personal kind of experience with not having your own vote counted or things like that. I think a lot of it reflects a kind of larger worldview about American society.
So in the 20 seconds we have left, Michael, are you concerned? How concerned are you, I guess I should ask, that we could see problems with the election results come November 9th?
Election fraud does happen on occasion. It's not to say that it doesn't exist, but I'm not very worried that it's going to swing the presidential election.
That is Michael Kang. He's professor at the Emory University School of Law. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're spending the hour today looking at voting issues in Georgia. We talked earlier about Donald Trump's claims that the vote may be rigged in November and how the voting system really works. The conversation around voter fraud has mainly centered on the issue of voter impersonation. That's the only type of fraud that could actually be possibly prevented by voter ID laws. But a new report from the nonpartisan journalism project News 21 found it is not widespread, and that's going pretty far, actually. They reviewed hundreds of allegations over the past 4 years from five states, including Georgia, and found none of the prosecuted cases involved voter impersonation. We have Georgia's Secretary of State with us now, Brian Kemp. It's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And also with us is Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Brian, we have fairly strong voter ID laws in Georgia. Has the voter ID laws, to your knowledge, prevented anyone from voting in Georgia?
No, not that I'm aware of. I think that was something that came through during our lawsuits that the state won and the Secretary of State's office won on all the voter ID lawsuits. There was never a voter that anybody could find that wasn't able to participate because they didn't have a photo ID. And we've been through, gosh, I don't know how many lawsuits, some of them before I got in office, and I think there was one or two after I was sworn in as Secretary of State. But, you know, the thing that's unique about our law here is if you don't have a photo ID and you're on the rolls, you can still vote an absentee ballot. And we'll also give you a free photo ID if you don't have one. So I think that's unique to some of the other photo ID laws that have passed around the country in the last several years. So we're, I think, on really good ground in Georgia. And I'm not sure what our latest number is, but the free photo IDs we've given out since 2006-07 when it was implemented, you know, the last time I looked, it was around 30,000 or so, give or take a few thousand, maybe 35. That's really not a lot when you hear news stories like I remember back to the North Carolina voter ID debate, and they were saying, you know, there's three or 400,000 people that didn't have photo IDs, and this was going to impact them. So, you know, I think there's a lot of rhetoric out there. My philosophy is I do think it helps us have more secure elections. That's why I'm support the
but
legislation.
But when you say secure elections, every investigation of voter fraud has shown that voter fraud that could be prevented by voter ID is basically non-existent. I mean, statistically.
Well, I would say it's non-existent in Georgia because we have the photo ID law. I mean, I don't know how you prove it if you don't have it, because people could go show, you know, in the old days, you could just go show a power bill. Well, how do you know who that person is? So, I mean, you can argue that, but there's no question that having people show up at a polling location and knowing who they are before they vote makes the election more secure.
Andre, your response to that, because some of the investigations that have gone, that went back before we had some of these voter ID laws, have also shown basically statistically no voter fraud in terms of in-person impersonation. However, we have had trouble with some absentee ballot fraud in some very small cases. And there have certainly been problems, like when they study some states, the fraud that arises is by and large much higher percentage are on the part of election officials. So how are we to handle this concept of voter fraud? If there is a problem, where is it?
So I think it's important to consider the history of attempts to restrict the franchise. And that really informs a lot of the debate. So it's not just what's happened in the last 10 years or even in the last 15 years with the Help America Vote Act, which did actually require a different level of identification in order to register to vote. And that was being done in response to September 11th. And so we still have to talk about othering that kind of goes along with that. But from a broader standpoint, if we think about the disenfranchising state conventions at the turn of the 20th century, so the late 19th and early 20th century, where states emboldened by Jim Crow laws changed their state constitutions to restrict access to the vote. And so this is the place where felon disenfranchisement gets introduced. And so this is the place where poll taxes and literacy tests and other types of things get introduced into the American voting culture. There is this inherent suspicion that any attempt to try to restrict voting is being intended to restrict access to minorities, in particular, particularly African Americans.
But is that true? Let's say in a place like Georgia, where, mm-hmm. as Brian was saying, that your ID is free. And as far as I know, Georgia is not one of those states that's closed down offices as has happened in other states where you might end up having to drive over 100 miles to get to a place to get your ID. I don't think that's happened in Georgia. So while the suspicion is there, is that suspicion founded?
So I think the suspicion kind of comes into which states were the first, especially as restrictions on what states could do tightened up, which states were the ones that were the first to be able to do that, and did people say things during legislative debates that would have suggested that they may have been attempting to restrict the rights to vote to some people. So people look at partisanship, and so they look at these laws being put forward by Republican state legislatures and an attempt to perhaps depress the Democratic vote, which, if you look at minority voting rates, you know, African Americans are going to be overwhelmingly Democratic. That's where people start to cry dirty pool, for instance. And so while, as far as I know, nobody in Georgia openly made those kinds of comments, there is evidence in other states.
In other states.
Yeah, like Pennsylvania, for instance, where people did openly say that they were trying to depress Democratic voter turnout. So I think because of that, and because oftentimes when states act, they don't act in isolation. States are individual laboratories of democracy, so states usually pick up on things that are going on in other states. It just calls the entire enterprise into question. And we do have to admit that, you know, by and large, most people, including minorities, support voter identification laws because they don't seem that difficult, because most people do have IDs. The question becomes, does it have a disproportionate impact on the registration of people who don't necessarily have access to the IDs? So those are the poor, those are the elderly, those are going to be disproportionately of color. And so does it make sense to make it harder for that particular group to vote when the evidence of voter fraud doesn't appear to be as widespread as most people think? About a third of people will say that they think voter fraud is a possibility, but the evidence just doesn't bear it out that happens widespread in this country. I think we have visions of Tammany Hall in our heads, and that really hasn't been the case in the United States for a really long time.
Well, one of the things when you compare, I mean, you can talk about all these reports and theories and everything else, but when you look at the numbers, when you compare the 2004 election to 2008, a presidential year, you know, before and after photo ID, 06
to 10. Yeah, from 04 to 08, I mean, the minority African-American turnout increased 42%. Hispanic turnout increased 140%.
And if you were saying that Republican legislators were trying to suppress minority participation, I mean, that's also like saying the Department of Homeland Security is trying to do the same thing to keep people from flying when they're checking your ID, when you have to go through security at the airport or to get other benefits, you know, SNAP and other things where you have to, you know, state Medicaid, I believe, other government benefits, you have to show a photo ID to get. I don't think those legislators are passing that to suppress minorities from participating in that. So I don't really buy that argument. I think the, you know, from my perspective, I mean, our philosophy is to have secure, accessible, and fair elections in Georgia. And we want to make the elections secure, but we also have done a tremendous amount in our state to make it easy for people to participate. When you think about online voter registration, I mean, anybody in Georgia that's got a driver's license can register to vote 24 hours a day, 7 days a week online now.
So what about automatic voter registration, which is something that at least two dozen states are considering it? Places like California have had a huge amount of success. When I say success, they've discovered it saved them money. They have had, they've been able to update people's addresses, and it's actually shown that it probably cuts down on voter fraud when it comes to absentee ballots, where there's actually been some evidence of
it. Well, I don't know if I would disagree with that. I'm not a fan of automatic voter registration. You know, I am a fan of the states running their elections. I think that's a big debate that we're fixing to have. So if California wants to have automatic voter registration, and that's what their legislative leaders want to do, then I think they ought to have the right to do that. I think that would be a bad mistake. I mean, I like the way that we have our voter registration set up here in Georgia. And look, there's some people that don't want to be registered. I mean, it's America. You can make up your mind what you want to do.
Well, they have an opt-out. You can opt out.
Yeah, but you got to opt out. I mean, why wouldn't you let people just opt in? You're having to take the same, you know, same amount of effort to opt out or opt in. You know, why not just let people register if they want to instead of automatically putting them in something? And I think that's going down a pretty scary place, in my opinion, for keeping our voter rolls secure.
So, Andre, what we're really talking about here, and one of the reasons that voter fraud is again rising up, especially here in Georgia, is not necessarily because of the voter ID laws, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think as far as I saw, less than 1% of the state's population here in Georgia actually had to obtain IDs in order to vote, which is tiny. But Georgia is a battleground state for the first time in at least two decades.
Well, in your opinion, it is.
Well, the polls all say that. The polls say that
it's
quite close.
Well, I'll remind you that
the
polls in 2014 said that Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter were beating Governor Deal and David Perdue, and the race was never close. There
so
was
you
no,
don't think that the race is close between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
I do not think we're a swing state to the effects of Ohio and other states.
And he's probably right about that. But for now, we have to look at the level of investment that the major candidates are actually expending into the state. And to the extent that they're spending into the state, that connotes whether or not they think it's competitive. And I think that that's what matters most. To answer your question, Celeste, about what does this mean? I mean, I've written about this. Yeah, Georgia's black voter turnout rates as a function of people who are registered to vote turning out hasn't declined. And so we will see what that looks like in this election cycle in particular. We think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that Barack Obama was on the ballot. So if we look at the 04 to 08 and 12 numbers, that there was a lot of motivation for people to turn out and vote. And I commend this state for not doing things to try to restrict voter access, even though I think we can argue about the shortening of early registration and the complaints. I mean, and if we look at the debates about early registration in the state, particularly in the Metro Atlanta region, where we talk about the placement of early voting locations and whether or not it was going to disproportionately affect one group or the other. People might not have overtly made racial comments, but race was kind of at the subtext of those comments. And I think especially for a state that has a checkered history as we do, I think there has to be a recognition and understanding that any change is going to garner suspicion because there was a past history. It doesn't mean that there isn't room for redemption there, but that people are going to ask the question because the history in this part of the country has, in fact, been very, very checkered. And then also think normatively about what it means to require people to register or to require people to go through hoops. Those inherently, every time you add another layer of responsibility or another barrier to voting, that's going to depress voter turnout. And so I think most people want to make elections as free and as open as possible, and that would be putting as few restrictions in place as possible without allowing people to, you know, without allowing dead people to vote or allowing people to go vote for other people.
I want to bring us back to the issue of voter fraud here. And Brian Kemp rejects the idea that the Georgia is a battleground state. But as you say, Hillary Clinton has decided to send a lot more staff down here and investing amounts in the six figures because she believes that it is. It could possibly swing votes here. As I understand it, Brian, you guys have had a number of complaints. This may not be updated, but I read that there were 18 complaints filed so far this year through the Stop Voter Fraud website.
Oh, I would think we'd probably have more than that. I mean, we get, you know, hundreds of complaints every election cycle. Now, there's a wide range to them. You know, we may get a complaint about somebody campaigning, you know, illegally within 150 feet of a polling location, or we may get a complaint about a polling location not being handicap accessible, somebody having a bumper sticker, you know, on their car in the parking lot. I mean, things that, you know, that is a complaint. We take every single complaint we get. It doesn't matter how big or how small. But then we have other, you know, on the other side, a range of complaints where you have, you know, absentee ballot fraud, intimidation at a polling location, you know, things of that, you know, vote buying, things of that nature.
I would be remiss if I walked away from this without at least getting you a chance to respond to the lawsuits that have been filed in the state of Georgia. There have been multiple ones, Project Vote, the NAACP, and Project Vote has been quite strong in their language, saying that, and I'm quoting here Michelle Cantor Cohen, who's election counsel for Project Vote, who says, "Secretary Kemp is illegally preventing us from figuring out just what exactly Georgia has been doing with its voter rolls." Your response to to that statement and these lawsuits?
Well, we'll see what the judge has to say about that. I would disagree with her. We have bent over backwards to provide all of the information that they've asked for, and then they're asking for some things that we had a hard time producing just because of the way our system is, and we're not going to give them complete access to our voter registration system. That would be giving away our security secrets and make us vulnerable to a cyber threat. So I'm not real worried about what she's saying about that. I can tell you that even when the lawsuit was filed, you know, they were asking for something different than they had before. So I personally think she's wasting the taxpayers of Georgia's money, and they ought to stop. But we're going to continue to fight that, and we'll fight the other lawsuits that are complaining about us keeping our voter rolls secure. I mean, it's a 7-year process to remove somebody from the voter rolls because they hadn't participated. And I think any Georgian with good common sense knows that people will actually leave the state and move somewhere else, and they may forget to notify their local election official. If they don't respond, we move them from active to inactive. Still keeps them on the rolls. They can still participate if they show up. But after two more general elections, if they don't participate, we'll send them another letter. And after that 7-year period, if they haven't responded to us or shown up to vote or sign a petition or anything else, we will finally remove them from the roll to keep our rolls secure and up to date.
That was Georgia's Secretary of State Brian Kemp and Emory University Professor Andra Gillespie. More of my conversation with them is at gpbnews.org. One lawsuit against Secretary Kemp was filed by Common Cause Georgia and the NAACP. Brinkley Circadakis of Common Cause Georgia says the state unlawfully removed voters from the rolls.
The fact of the matter is that here in Georgia, the way that you begin a purge process in many cases is by looking at that voter's history to see whether or not they voted in the last series of elections. Unfortunately, our Secretary of State looks at that and says, oh, well, this person is eligible for a purge. When you can't do that, you have that right to sit that election out.
The small town of Sparta, Georgia, is about 100 miles southeast of Atlanta. The town made headlines earlier this year. A lawsuit claims the Hancock County Board of Elections and Registration systematically questioned the registrations of more than 180 voters, most of them African American. Voters say the board sent sheriff's officers to people's doors and served them summons with orders to appear in court and prove their residency. Marty Flannoy is one of these voters and involved in the lawsuit. He spoke with producer Linda Chen and recounts what happened.
I was walking from my apartment, which is on Broad Street, and all of a sudden, I seen a police officer approach me on the driver's side. And he broke down the window. Hey, sir, come here. And I'm like, I haven't did anything. He said, no, I ain't trying to do that to you right now. And he just served me a subpoena. He really did kind of make me nervous about the whole situation because I ain't too familiar with police and we don't get along that good. I took the subpoena and I went down my cousin's house. She told me that we had to go to court. From there, I had ended up showing my lease and a copy of my registration, which is my driver's license. Why did I get subpoenaed and what's the reason why they approached me that way, which they could have just called my phone or whatever I had, but I was just humiliated.
We reached out to the Hancock County Board of Elections for comment. We did not hear back from them in time for this broadcast. The lawsuit is still pending. Not long ago, elections officials would have needed approval from the U.S. Justice Department to purge voters' names off the rolls. That changed in 2013 when the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. In 70 days, we will carry out the first presidential election since those changes were made in the Voting Rights Act. What effect might that have? I'm joined from New York by Ari Berman. He's writer for The Nation and also author of the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is David Becker. He was an attorney with the U.S. Justice Department, where he monitored thousands of polling sites in the early 2000s. Thanks for being here as well again, David.
Thank you, Celeste.
So, Ari, what effects could we see because of those changes in the Voting Rights Act? How is it different for a presidential election as opposed to local elections?
Well, we're seeing a big impact from the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. As you mentioned, this is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, and it's the first presidential election since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. And so we're seeing the impact both on a state level and at a local level. On a state level, states have passed more sweeping voting restrictions that would have been blocked under the Voting Rights Act previously. And on the local level, we're seeing an impact that things like in Sparta, where black voters are being purged from the rolls or polling places are being shut down in majority black neighborhoods. Those are the very type of things that the Voting Rights Act had previously stopped. So we're seeing an impact both on the state level and at the local level. And it's very distressing that we're 70 days away from the election and this stuff is going on.
David, Ari describes what happened in the Supreme Court as gutting the Voting Rights Act. Is that fair?
Well, it had a very significant impact on the ability of the Justice Department to enforce voting rights laws in the states that were covered by Section 5. I think, without question, federal oversight in states that had traditionally seen voting rights problems, civil rights problems, has been significantly impacted. I think one other thing to keep in mind, though, is that the election officials across the country are trying to do a very difficult job, especially in a presidential election year. Certainly what happened in Sparta seems like it's likely excessive, given what I understand about it. But in most places, election officials are trying to do the very difficult job of keeping the voter list as up-to-date and accurate as possible, making sure that all eligible voters who want to be on the rolls are, but only eligible voters are as well, and they have the most up-to-date information on where those people live so they can get them the correct information, send them to the right polling place, and thus avoid problems on election day. Georgia and other states, of course, especially in presidential election years, can see very long lines in a presidential election year because it's the one time every 4 years that we see such large numbers of people all coming to a single location at the same period of time to exercise their civic rights.
So, Ari, when we talk about purging of voter rolls, there are ways to do that in a fair and constitutional way. Have you seen instances, Ari, this time around of purging of voter rolls that are not fair?
Well, what's happening in Sparta, just as one example, is very alarming. It appears that African-American voters are being purged there for both racial and political reasons. The fact that law enforcement is being used is incredibly disturbing. This is a direct echo of things that happened during Jim Crow and after. I write in my book, Give Us the Ballot, for example, when many voters were enfranchised in states like Alabama, you had sheriffs who previously enforced segregation that would come to people's houses when they requested things like absentee ballots to make sure that they weren't home on election day. Otherwise, they were going to be charged by a crime. So there's a long history of law enforcement being used in a discriminatory manner to suppress voting rights. There's a long history of black voters being purged from the voting rolls or not allowed to even register in the first place. So when it happens again in a state like Georgia with a long history of this discrimination, we have to be very wary of it, in my opinion.
So, David, what are the limits of voter purges, and how does somebody go about challenging if they've been purged off the list? How do you do that?
So, again, election officials in Georgia's 159 counties and at the state level and, of course, across the country have this very hard job. There's a lot of mobility that occurs within a four-year period of time when most people vote. And so,
you mean they may have moved out of state or moved to another county?
Exactly. Or even within the county to a different address. So trying to keep up with that mobility is very, very difficult. And this is part of the research that I've done over my past 20 years in working in elections. And it's a legitimate challenge. It's a very difficult thing to try to make sure that you have accurate information on all the voters. And so there, under the National Voter Registration Act, which was passed in 1993, there is a process. The process is that election officials are allowed to contact voters, usually by mail, see if mail has been returned as undeliverable or something along those lines. And then if that's the case, if a piece of mail gets returned, for instance, what they can do is then what's called inactivate that voter from the list. That just means that that voter's record stays on the list. It's flagged as inactive. And if the voter has any contact with election officials within the next two federal election cycles, so it could be somewhere between 2 to 4 years, that voter's instantly activated. So if they show up to vote, if they sign a petition, if they show up at the election office, whatever, if any kind of contact, they instantly get activated. So that's an intermediate step before what's commonly called a purge, where that registration is effectively canceled, and they can no longer vote. That process generally works pretty well so long as the information that election officials receive is solid, and that's always a challenge for election officials. I don't know a single election official in the country, Republican or Democrat, anywhere in the country, who wants to remove an eligible voter from the list. But I also don't know many who want to keep people who are otherwise ineligible, maybe because they moved out of the state or because they've died, on the list. And it's a very careful balance that they need to set to make sure that the lists are as accurate and up-to-date as possible. Because if the lists are inaccurate, if people are on the list but with bad information because they've moved, that will cause delays at the polls on election day, and those election officials are sure going to hear about it.
And Ari, we get this question from Joel Cook on Twitter, who says, what if someone isn't registered and decides last minute? That's different from a voter purge. What has shifted in the country, and especially in Georgia, in terms of when you can register and whether you can do it same day?
Well, this is a big problem in many states, is that lots of states have registration deadlines, for example, in October. So there could be a presidential debate, people could be tuning in, and it's too late to register to vote in a bunch of states in the country. And that's why something like Election Day registration is so valuable in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota that have had Election Day registration in place since the 1970s. Voter turnout has increased by up to 10%. So that's really the one way we know to get more people on the voter rolls. I also just want to say something about automatic registration, because Secretary Kemp said that he's not in favor of that in Georgia.
Yeah.
Automatic registration is one way to not only get a lot more people registered, but to make the voter rolls more secure, because you'll have better databases. David could speak to this more, but I was just in Oregon, which is the first state to implement automatic voter registration. And their voter rolls are far more accurate now and far more secure than they were before they had this form of automatic registration. And more than 200,000 people have been added to the voter rolls. So it's having a very big impact in terms of both adding new people and in terms of making voter rolls more secure, which is a stated Republican priority.
We are getting a lot of responses from people listening, and we would love to get your thoughts out there as well. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on on Facebook. My guests are writer Ari Berman of The Nation and election expert David Becker. David, automatic registration means that you're basically, it's tied to your driver's license, which explains why it's more accurate, because most of us get our driver's license updated more often than we do our voter registration. And in fact, we got a question from one of our listeners saying, Fleming Stone says, I'd like to hear more of Kemp's reasons against automatic registration. His ability to deny hard evidence is astounding. Could automatic voter registration become a federal policy?
Well, I think we've seen challenges in trying to get any kind of national policies through Congress, including in the election area. And there's some very good reasons not necessarily to implement a national policy with a one-size-fits-all solution for all the states in some cases. So, for instance, things like very good reforms like online voter registration was started because states started experimenting with that. Arizona started experimenting with it in 2002, and then Washington State followed in 2008. Now 32 states have online voter registration. It's very unlikely an interesting and very positive reform like that would have first come from Washington and been implemented, imposed upon the states from Washington. So there's some really good aspects of letting the states experiment with new reforms. And certainly automatic voter registration, same-day registration, things like online voter registration and data sharing that some states are doing through things like the Electronic Registration Information Center, which I helped co-found.
Ari, one of the things that has been spoken of here is whether or not challenges to voter purges, and we have a couple lawsuits here in Georgia filed by Common Cause and by the NAACP, are politically motivated. And Michael Kang of Emory even suggested that that's become part of the political strategy to file lawsuits to challenge votes. What have we seen of that? And especially because people are predicting that Georgia could possibly be a battleground state.
Well, there's a lot of evidence in Georgia that people are being purged from the voting rolls in places like Sparta, and that lawsuits needed to be filed. So I can't speak to the motivations of all of the lawsuits, but the evidence I've seen in some of these local jurisdictions is quite compelling, and it makes sense that lawsuits were filed. And there's litigation all across the country over restrictive voting laws. These kind of voter purges can have a very big impact. If I can just tell a quick story about what happened during the 2000 election in Florida. Thousands of people were wrongly labeled as felons in Florida and purged from the voting rolls. Florida was one of only a few states that prevented ex-felons from voting at the time. And people who were legit registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons. They were prevented from voting. After the election, the NAACP sued Florida after that very close disputed 2000 election in Florida. And it turned out that 12,000 registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting. And that was 22 times George W. Bush's 537 vote margin of victory. And we only learned about this after the election, when it was too late, when the results had already been decided, when George W. Bush had already become president, when people could not get their right to vote back. So when people are removed from the voting rolls, often it is for good reasons. But if it's not for good reasons, we have to do something about it before it's too late.
So, Ari, we have a number of things that are of concern as we approach this election, to my mind. One is the fact that, as we mentioned, this is the first presidential election since the Supreme Court made those changes to the Voting Rights Act. Then there's this issue, the specter of foreign hacking, which the FBI says we have evidence has occurred in a couple states. We have some lawsuits going forward. There's a lot of different things happening. Not to mention Donald Trump claiming that the election may be rigged in places, and also the thought on some people's minds that one of the candidates, should they lose, not concede. What are you concerned about? What are you watching for in November?
What I am concerned about are efforts to make it harder to vote that prevent legitimately eligible citizens from being able to vote. What I'm also concerned about is that phony rhetoric about the likelihood of voter fraud that we're hearing from the Trump campaign and others is going to deter people from participating, is going to lead to more voting restrictions, and is also going to lead to a culture of intimidation at the polls. Remember, Trump has called on law enforcement to monitor the voting on election day in places like Pennsylvania, which is not only illegal in states like Pennsylvania, but could lead to a chilling atmosphere at the poll. So I believe we're in a very toxic place when it comes to the fact that there are laws making it harder to vote. And then there's this whole narrative about the likelihood of fraud, which is very misplaced, that is going to lead, in my view, to a culture of potentially intimidation and problems on election day that I think it's very, very important to debunk before it's too late.
We only have 30 seconds left, Ari, but are all those things you're concerned about that? Does that only come into play, do you think, if the election is close?
It certainly has a bigger impact if the election is close. I mean, we noticed the impact of new voting restrictions in elections like in Florida 2000 that are decided by 537 votes. My opinion is that if anyone is turned away from the polls, that's wrong. But I think we can see more of a political impact, certainly in close races. And I think we're going to see close races in Georgia and elsewhere in 2016.
That is Ari Berman of The Nation, who also wrote the book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We lost touch with election expert David Becker. Ari, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you, Celeste. Thank you.
That's our show for today. But do you plan to vote? A lot of people say they're frustrated with politics and they just might stay home. Are you one of them? Call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk or at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.